science, technology, society, our lives, philosophy, and religion. This is Spark Dialogue Podcast, where it all comes together. I'm Elizabeth Fernandez.
Imagine being in space, hundreds of thousands of miles from Earth. Suddenly, you hear an explosion. Your space module shakes, and warning lights flash. Your survival comes down to literally figuring out how to fit a square peg into a round hole. This is exactly the situation that the astronauts of the Apollo 13 mission encountered. Most of us may remember that iconic scene in the movie based on the scenario. Engineers dumping out a box of hundreds of random items on a table, trying to come up with a clever way to save the astronauts' lives, using only those objects available to them 200,000 miles away from home. Now imagine an alternate scenario, a similar emergency, but this time the astronauts can obtain any tool they need, even if it was not brought to them in a rocket. How is this possible? Today we're talking to Brad Kohlenberg, business development engineer, who works for a company called Made in Space. The goal of this company is to move production of items off Earth and into space. So, Brad, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, what does Made in Space seek to do?
Made in Space was founded to explore the technologies necessary to allow humanity to live permanently and sustainably in space. They wanted to really lower the barrier of entry to space and create a boon in the space industry similar to that we've seen in the computer industry. Just like in the computer industry, it was the lowering of the barrier of entry to computers that allowed us to go from a world in which only governments and billionaires could operate with computers to a world in which high schoolers can make a website over a weekend. How could we do that for space? And they kept coming back to the problem of launch. Launch from Earth is just really, really expensive. And was there a way that we could avoid that altogether? And so the idea was, can we manufacture things in space? Can we just, if we had the resources up there already, is there a way that we can just build the things we need in space right there in that environment? So just like that, we looked at a business case where we could supply tools to the astronauts on the ISS. And if we could do that, that would kind of lay the groundwork for us to be able to do these larger things where we could build outside the space station and build these kind of larger things that we've always really dreamed about doing in space.
Okay, so how do you go about building these things?
It depends on what you want to build. So right now, Made in Space has a 3D printer on the International Space Station. So we're designing tools, we're printing tools, parts, spare parts, just like in the Apollo 13 situation. We've been able to manufacture things that we didn't expect we would ever need to. These weren't, you know, very critical, life-threatening situations. They were just situations where NASA could have either waited several months to get a part to them, or we were able to get a part to them in a couple of days.
Okay, so you mentioned the cost of bringing things up into space in comparison to printing them in space as it is. So do you know how much it would cost to, say, bring a certain item up into space via a rocket as opposed to printing it in space?
There's one way you can look at it, which is just the physical cost of launching the amount of material you would need versus printing it. There's some things to consider. So, for example, whenever you launch something, you have to go through what's called launch integration. So that means vibration testing. That means electromagnetic interference testing. There's a lot of testing that goes into every single thing that you ever launch into space just to ensure, not that it will survive space, just ensuring that something can get to space safe. A lot of what we launch ends up being over-engineered, overly robust, again, just to survive that very short ride to space. But let's say if the end-use product doesn't need to be very heavy, doesn't need to be very mass, maybe it can be this light, gossamer, dexterous object that's perfect for the space environment, but would never survive a launch. It might not even survive its own weight on Earth. It might collapse under its own weight.
So I guess this is something we normally don't think of when we're on Earth, the structural integrity of a lot of the things around us, and especially getting into orbit. And so by thinking of the designs of these items and these tools that you're printing out that are just going to spend their entire lives in space and they never have to support their own weight in a gravitational field, does this mean you can design things to be different in space rather than their Earth counterparts?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So we actually are really excited to see what kinds of things will be made because, you know, we'll be able to explore a new realm of design, something humans have never really been able to look at before, which is designs for zero gravity.
So I imagine when you're printing something in space, you have a whole host of problems that you don't have to worry about on Earth. So what are some of the problems that you have that are unique to the zero gravity environment?
Yeah, it's probably one of our number one questions we get, actually. What did we have to do fundamentally different to 3D printing for it to work in zero gravity? Kind of the big secret there, I think, that everyone wants to hear about, there actually wasn't much that had to change with the 3D printing process itself. You can imagine a hot glue gun being scraped against a board. Because the extruder, the hot end, is so close to the build platform, you never give the material a chance to bead and to drop. So gravity never takes over. In fact, surface tension dominates throughout the entire process. However, the building of the printer, the building of a 3D printer that could survive a rocket launch, that could operate accurately after that rocket launch, that could be remotely operable from Earth, that could easily be maintained and modulated and augmented with quick one-handed operations by the astronauts. All of this took a lot of work. Probably the biggest thing we had to do was safety. We had a huge stack of 200 kind of safety requirements that we had to meet, everything from the color of certain buttons down to filtering out nanoparticles and toxic acid.
Okay, I have to ask, how does the color of a button affect the safety of a printer?
Right, so that's a good question, and it's one I asked as well. So basically, there is already kind of a color-coded scheme on the ISS for everything, and so astronauts kind of know that red means something, blue means something, white means something, and you don't want to have like mismatched buttons, because if red means abort on every other machinery on the station, but it means go on your machine, you know, it could just cause confusion.
So I imagine that independent of zero G, you have issues of the printer being in a very confined space as well. So things like off-gassing of the material, maybe that's an issue, or heat dissipation. Are those things you have to deal with as well?
When you're in zero gravity, heat doesn't rise. There's no buoyancy. So you don't get natural convection. So you have to kind of create artificial convection. So you can do that with fans. So we do have a system inside the printer that is circulating the air, which helps to both create a uniform temperature throughout the build volume, but then it also allows us to then force the air through filters and things that allow us to get rid of the toxic gases and nanoparticles so that all the air coming out of the printer is cleaner than the air going into the printer.
So building this printer on Earth, there's a lot of things you obviously can't test on Earth. We can't test it in zero gravity on Earth. So how do you go about testing that this printer is actually going to work once you get it up into space?
Yeah, that's another fun question we get sometimes. People wonder if there's a zero gravity room somewhere on Earth that you go to. And it's a good question. Unfortunately, we don't have that technology yet. So the two kind of main approaches we take here on Earth are drop towers and parabolic flights. With drop towers, you can hope to get 4 to 5 seconds of microgravity time. Right now, the kind of gold standard is parabolic flights. So that's where you get into a plane and you essentially take giant roller coaster ride type parabolas through the air. And that gets you to about 20 second bursts of microgravity per parabola. And then you can do about 40 parabolas per flight. And you can do up to like 2 flights per day. But anyway, so you can kind of get a lot of microgravity time. Unfortunately, it's not continuous microgravity time. So you have to be kind of clever with how you go about proving what you're trying to prove in microgravity. What we did to kind of get around that is, rather than just trying to print within the 20-second microgravity bursts, we figured out a way to where we could print throughout the entire flight profile. So in a way, our printer isn't so much a zero-gravity printer as it is a gravity-independent printer.
Yeah, that sounds like a good thing to test. So have you gone on these parabolic flights?
I have. Yeah, in February of this year, actually, I went, and it was really cool. So we did the parabolic flights to test the 3D printer. Just as we adapted 3D printing to zero gravity, we're trying to adapt other additive manufacturing technologies to microgravity. So you can imagine things like metal printing, resin, SLA-type printing, bioprinting, some basic mechanical processes like grindings and things like that. Because ultimately, our name is Made in Space, not 3D printing plastic on the ISS. So we want to be able to make anything and everything in the space environment.
Okay. So I see that you've already printed out quite a few tools in space. So what kind of things are you printing right now?
I think it's close to 80 parts so far now in space. By far, the majority of them have been a series of engineering test coupons that we hope will give us a statistical sampling of what we can expect to see when we do make these things in space, because NASA's a lot very concerned that they really want to know that they can rely on these parts once they're made, and that these parts aren't going to just break on them. But on the private side, we've worked with commercial groups to do things like STEM outreach, where we printed, for example, a part that was designed by a high schooler. It was a multi-purpose maintenance tool. We've been able to print a few things that NASA's requested that, you know, we didn't plan to print. This wasn't part of the statistical sampling or anything like that. For example, there was an attachment on a vacuum. They could have waited 2 months to get it launched to them, or we were able to just design it and 3D print it. Another thing we were able to print recently is something they call the OGA adapter, which is oxygen generator adapter adapter. And yeah, again, it was just kind of one of these things where it's like, oh, we just need this very unique geometry mount thing, or we can try and get off the ruler and duct tape and try to MacGyver something. But yeah, we were able to print it, and they were able to use it. And so it's another kind of cool use case. Not quite the Apollo 13, like, lives on the line kind of situation, but still speeding things up and making things easier and faster and more efficient for the space station.
Okay. So what materials can you print with?
Yeah, so we actually have two printers on the space station. So for the first prototype printer, we chose ABS plastic, which is the same plastic found in Legos. After the success of that, we immediately started making a printer that can print with a wide range of materials. So we've been able to print with ABS, PLA, nylon, PEEK, PEIPC, or Ultim as it's known by its proprietary name, HDPE, polyethylene. What gets people really excited is the PEEK and the Ultim printing, because those are polymers that can actually survive in the vacuum of space, which is really interesting and cool. Most of these polymers break down from either the radiation or the thermal expansion or the off-gassing. They just degrade and break apart. But these other materials have very low off-gassing, very good thermal expansion coefficients, and they can, you know, survive in these radiation environments. And they're very, very strong and lightweight. What we're seeing is that, yeah, now these polymers can actually best metals in some of the strength-to-weight ratio performance issues, right?
So can you print with metal as well?
So we're working on metal printing. A lot of metal printing on Earth right now is done using sintering with powder beds. And you can imagine powder is hard to work with in microgravity, but a bigger challenge is actually just the power. The power budget on the ISS is pretty limited, and the power it requires to melt metal, especially titanium and aluminum metal, is very high. And so if those are the kinds of metals you want, then it's going to be hard to make that happen on the ISS. However, you can do things with lower melting point metals that don't take as much energy, or you can look at going outside the space station where you can create your own kind of power situation, which is specifically dedicated to just that process.
Okay. So I imagine if you can print with metal, then you might be able to print things like circuits or electronics and things like that.
Exactly. So one of the areas we're looking at, one of the things we did actually on the parabolic test earlier this year, was very early electronic circuitry printing.
So what about recycling? So let's say an astronaut uses a tool and then doesn't need it anymore. Can we just take that material that tool is made out of, melt it down, throw it back in the printer, and then you can make another tool with it?
Yeah, exactly right. So this was actually one of the projects we were expecting to be working on immediately after the printer, was a material recycler. So something that could not just break down things you've already printed and no longer need, but even break down some of the trash you have up there or some of the launch packaging that you have to launch up there. There's a lot that goes up to space that we spend millions of dollars just to get it there that ultimately is just trash. Like, there's water bottles, you know, that all they do is carry water and then they become trash. Foam packaging. All they do is insulate things to survive the ride and then become trash. All this stuff right now is just, you know, they squeeze it down into a little hockey puck and then they throw it out the airlock and then burn it up in reentry. But wouldn't it be great is if you could repurpose that mass that you've already spent, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars getting there and turn it into usable goods and functional things.
How long does it take to print out a tool?
Yeah, so it depends on the tool. A lot of people are familiar with the ratcheting wrench that we printed. Mm-hmm. That took about 2 hours, but we do have designs for things that take up to 8 hours.
So I imagine that you can print out things potentially that could be quite large, maybe even larger than what you can fit on a rocket, because when you have to launch something up into space, you either have to make it small enough to fit on a rocket or foldable so it could fit on a rocket to get into space. But if you make it in space, you don't have to worry about this constraint. So is there any size limitation to what you can make?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that's kind of the vision that we have for one of our next projects, which is called Arkanaut. Arkanaut is really just, you can think of it like a 3D printer that can print things bigger than itself. Yeah, so with the printer that's up there right now, we are constrained by the print volume, unless we do tricks like assembling things that are larger that are printed in small pieces, or you can do like 4D printing where it kind of prints in a compacted folded form, then just like a rocket fairing, it unfolds once it comes out of the printer. But other than that, you're pretty limited. So with Arkanaut, which is essentially a series of technologies that will live outside the space station and operate in the vacuum of space, we are exactly looking for that, the ability to print and really unbounded in terms of volume.
You showed me something earlier that I found really amazing. The fact that there are certain things that you can print in space that you actually can't print on Earth. And so this is sort of moving the supply chain in the opposite direction, making things in space and then bringing them down to Earth. So what kind of things can we make in space that we can't do on Earth?
Yeah, so a project we call Made in Space Fiber will be launching a material called Zeblan, which is a heavy metal fluoride glass, which theoretically can create fiber optics that have 10x the performance of anything we can make on Earth. The reason for that is that when you try to pull these compounds into glass fibers here on Earth, there's some kind of aberration that occurs, and either crystals are formed or something happens to where the clarity goes down, and the best guess is that that's due to gravity. So the theory has been that if we can pull these fibers in zero gravity, those aberrations won't exist. That right there is probably the very first time something will come from space that has never been to Earth before. Like, as you put it, it's reversing the supply chain, and things are coming to Earth for the first time, and we're selling them off, and really becoming that much more of a space-faring civilization.
Right. So there's been a lot of talk recently of humans going back to space as far as going back to the moon and potentially even going to Mars to visit or maybe even colonize there. So how do you see this as a potential step to that happening?
So in-space manufacturing has fundamentally already changed that equation. For decades, the leading experts always assumed that we would have to launch 3 rockets for every 1 rocket of humans we wanted to send, because they needed supplies and resources and structures, and they would have to build out their habitats once they got there. With the invention of robotics and computers, we thought, okay, maybe we'd have machines that would do this, but we still thought we'd have to send all these supplies. That's changed. Now, rather than us sending all of the material we need, just the raw material we need from Earth, we can go to these places and find material there. And so one of the ideas is for Mars, for example, it's 1.5 years away. If you go there with everything you need and you treat it like a camping trip, if you forget something, you're 1.5 years away from getting that thing you need. So it's really, really dangerous if you don't have an ability to make the things you need when you need them. So now, rather than sending 3 rockets, you actually maybe only need to send 1/2 rocket. And maybe in 1/2 rocket, you have a 3D printer, but also a device that allows that 3D printer to use things in that environment as feedstocks for your manufacturing needs.
Well, I think this is remarkable technology, and I think it has potential to change a lot when it comes to space. So thank you for joining us for the podcast today.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure.
If you want to see the printers of Made in Space and some examples of what they print, this podcast has an associated video, the first episode of Spark Dialogue Video. Check it out at sparkdialogue.com/madeinspace. Before we wrap up, I want to let you all know that Spark Dialogue Podcast now has a Facebook page at facebook.com/sparkdialogue. We're still going strong on Twitter with our latest crazy and awesome science news at Spark Dialogue. And as always, thanks for listening.
This is Elizabeth Fernandez for Spark Dialogue Podcast. If you like us, don't forget to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. Thanks for listening.